Is this closer to me than it usually is? I have long arms. I feel like I'm just going to knock it flying here, so I'll just slide it over a little bit. Okay, there. Okay, I feel good now. So we're doing a Lent series, and we're being guided in our Lent series by Cynthia Molobita, who is a professor of ethics, theological ethics, I guess, officially, and she's written a book called Resisting Structural Evil. Very complicated title, but it's the kind of work that this congregation does all the time. So she's kind of been our muse for the series. And I found out in reading the book that she does a lot of her writing at a local coffee shop. She tells this story. "What are you writing about?" asked a man sitting down at the table next to mine in the coffee shop. This is always the fear of pastors, right? When you're on a plane or you're in a coffee shop and somebody's going to lean over and say, "Hey, what are you writing about?" And then you have to tell them, and then, oh my goodness, the places you go after that. "What are you writing about?" he said. "Oh, you don't want to know," Cynthia responded with a sigh. "I'm trying to deal with what it means to live a moral life, given that we are killing people all over the world through climate change and by taking their land to grow our snow peas, destroying their fishing communities to build resorts, and poisoning their water supplies to make Coca-Cola." I know, he interrupted. "Listen, I totally agree with you." "You do?" she said. "Look, any sentient person in America knows there's a gnawing sense of guilt. We know we're destroying the planet. We also know that we're the ones who can fix it. We have the money, the science, the power." So she asked, "What do you do about it?" "What do I do about it? What does anyone do about it?" "Nothing." It's an uncomfortable laugh at that point, isn't it? Because it's like, yeah. I buy another latte or a toy for my car. "Listen, I drive a big gas-eating car. Hey, I'm a total socialist, but it doesn't change anything I do," he confessed. "What's there to do? I don't see much changing." Does this conversation ring a bell with you? Does it sound at all familiar to you? It does to me, because it's the internal conversation that goes on in my head all the live long day. Everything I buy, every choice I make, has a bad impact on other people somewhere on the planet. And what am I doing? Now, I think Cynthia's point is that being a moral person, her point in her book is that being a moral person, or being a person of spiritual vision, is more than just knowing what to do. Most of us know what to do. And if we don't know what to do, there is a website out there that will tell you exactly what you need to do and what you need to buy and what's fair trade and so on. But there's something else that's even more important than knowing what to do. Something that we don't spend a whole lot of time reflecting on or thinking about. And that is, where do you get the power to actually do the right thing? Where does that come from? Cynthia's coffee mate surely knows what to do. We know what to do, but for some reason, guilt or helplessness or just feeling completely hopeless about the magnitude of these problems, we just don't always quite get there. So, where does that power to do the right thing come from? Cynthia takes us back to a medieval religious group for some answers. The group is known as the Beguines, not to be confused with the song, Begin the Beguine. I know now you'll have it in your head for the rest of the day. Da 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 da. Okay. And so the Beguines, medieval religious group, and they were awesome. Awesome. They were a group of northern, mostly, they were European, they were mostly women, they lived in cloisters from the 12th to the 14th centuries. But they refused to follow the conventions of that day, of keeping separated from the world. And they insisted on serving the world and serving the poor. Imagine that. Some of the women were mystics. Some of the women wrote theological books, which in medieval times, women writing theology, absolute no-no. They challenged the male hierarchy of that day. And just as in our day, when the heterosexual male white leadership feels under threat, what happens? People get on the margins, are persecuted. They're further marginalized. Thank goodness that we no longer burn at the stake those that we perceive as heretics. But tragically, some of the Beguines were. So where did the Beguines draw their moral courage to stand up against the powers of the day, to live their lives and put their lives at risk? Well, from their writings, we know that they had a deep understanding of God as love itself. That seemed to be their central teaching. Now, I know you're thinking, oh my goodness, that's it? I mean, isn't that just kind of basic to Christianity? God is love? Well, the truth is, yes, it is basic to Christianity, but we have struggled to keep that as a central focus in the church over the ages. There are so many competing images of God. Even in our own denomination, there are competing images of God. Yes, God is love, but also God as lawgiver, God as judge, God as purifier. So that God as love itself sometimes just gets lost in the shuffle. Or maybe worse, it's just given lip service and never acted out. But this is the way the Beguines saw themselves, as God sees them. They saw themselves through the very eyes of God. They knew themselves as in God, as beloved by God, as lovers of God. Those were the primary images in their writings. What happens when you see yourself in God? When you understand that God's very self is coursing through your veins like an underground stream and through the veins of all of your neighbors, might you find in that resources of courage and of hope to stand up to the powers that be? Some of you have probably heard the story about a monastery that fell on hard times. Fewer people were making their way out on trips to the monastery. The monks were getting kind of contentious. They were getting, sort of petty and jealous, and some of them weren't speaking to each other, and the abbot was distressed and didn't really know what to do, so he went to visit his dear friend, a Jewish rabbi, and just poured his heart out about the woes of the monastery. Well, the rabbi listened, and then he said, I want to tell you something. I've had a vision. I've had a vision that the Messiah has returned, and the Messiah has taken residence up at your monastery. Well, the abbot was beside himself. I mean, he knew that it wasn't him, so who could it be? He ran back to the monastery, shared the news. The monks grew kind of silent, and they looked around at each other like, is he the Messiah, the one that I haven't spoken to in 2 years? Is he the Messiah, the one that we got in an argument this morning about washing the dishes? You can guess what happened, right? The monastery completely transformed. Bitterness was healed. The community grew in love and compassion. And word spread of the spirit of peace that emanated from that place. And pilgrims came from near and far to be at that monastery. So I guess maybe using that story, we could spread the rumor on social media that the Messiah is at University Church, and it's not one of the pastors. It's there somewhere, Messiah. Or Even better, we could spread the reality that everyone here, everyone we meet today, everyone who serves us, and everyone whom we serve through our work is loved by God beyond all human comprehension. We could spread it, and we could live it, and we could mean it. You know, since at least the third century, Holy Communion has been seen by some groups of people as a school of seeing, a vision school. There was an ancient practice that I read about recently, which we modern people would probably find a little gross and unsanitary. It was the practice of receiving the bread and cup, and while they're still fresh in your mouth, you moisten your fingers, and then you place them on your eyes and on your ears and on your mouth. Not only so that you might begin to see and to hear and to speak about the realities and the people and the injustices that we so often ignore, but also to give us the faith, the hope, and the love to respond and to act. What if churches like ours became schools of seeing? Vision schools. Schools where we're trained in worship and in small groups to see that our neighbors have infinite worth and are extravagantly loved by God. What if our morning greeting went like this? Welcome, everybody. We're glad you're here. The reason we're here is to help each other grow in love. That's it. Love for neighbor, love for self, love for the earth, love for God. What if every prayer we offered up, or in prayer we offered up everything that gets in the way of our love? What if we wrote new creeds that took the focus off belief and put the focus on love? What if our communion liturgy kind of separated out the language of bloody sacrifice and spoke instead of Eucharist, of a love feast, of a way to bind us through a meal to the love of Jesus? I came across a very brave invitation to communion. It was given at a church in South Carolina way back in the 1960s. Okay, you're in a church in South Carolina, the 1960s. It's right before communion, and here's what the preacher is saying to you. Sadly, those of us who gather at the altar to eat with Jesus refuse to eat at a dime store lunch counter with his brothers and sisters whose skin isn't the same color as ours. May God forgive us. What if we were very gently, but very specifically called out when our love is inconsistent? I don't know, maybe we're not ready for all of that kind of change, but couldn't we at least take some small steps? Stephen Tomlinson, who is our other Lent muse, you know, it takes some churches a whole village of muses to make it through Lent, right? So we have Stephen, who is inviting us to give up complaining for Lent, to give up not doing anything, and to notice what's going on right in front of us, and then to take steps in love and devotion, and then report back, tell someone. 2 years ago, I was at a rally at the Capitol. It was about sensible gun regulations. I think it was with Moms Demand Action, which is a fantastic group. We were actually gathered off to the side, and we were waiting for another rally to finish up. The other rally was Bikers Against Refugees. I'm not making it up. Bikers Against Refugees. So I said to our group, hey, let's go over there and see what's going on, see what they're talking about. So I wandered over there, and I listened in, and someone at the rally spotted me and walked right over to me, decked out, leather jacket, sidearm, straggly hair, bandana, lots of really bad tattoos. My heart rate increased as it dawned on me that I was now alone. No one from my rally had followed me over to the other rally. He reached out to shake my hand. I guess he noticed my clerical collar. "Hey, preacher." So I asked him about his event. "Oh, we're just concerned about all those people coming over the border, you know. We want everyone to be safe, so we're all going to ride down to the border and help out." "How about you?" he asked. "What's your rally about?" "Oh, dear," I told him. He said, "Huh, so I guess your rally is kind of the exact opposite of my rally." Awkward smiles followed by lots of awkward silence. And then he said, "You know, I guess we're all trying to make the world a bit better. I hope your rally goes well. I really do. You be safe now, preacher." And he shook my hand again, and he walked back to his rally. That was such an uncomfortable conversation, but I came away wondering, did he somehow see me as beloved? Did he just welcome me with open arms to his rally? If he had walked up to my rally, would I have been so kind and so welcoming? It left me wishing that somehow I could have more conversations like that. So it was a small step, right? It was a small step. It wasn't, "Gosh, I think I need to go follow Jesus and transform the world, so I'm just going to step right over there and I'm going to talk to those folks." It was more like a nudge, like a whisper. Just go over there and just be with those people for a little while. So the funny thing that I found about small steps, if you take one, you just might take another one. And then before you know it, you look back and lo and behold, you are on the path following Jesus. May it be so, my friends, for you and for me by the power of God's Spirit in us. Amen.